Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most interesting fronts in that war at the moment, it would appear, is, believe it or not, Capitol Hill. And that would be the case as a result of an investigation that has been brought to our attention, notably by a terrific investigative reporter at the Daily Caller. His name is Luke Rosiak. He has had experience with a number of other outlets, including as a watchdog reporter for the Washington Examiner, also a reporter for the Washington Post and Washington Times. He's very good to give us a little bit of his time to talk about a story about a criminal investigation that is apparently underway now involving some IT contract supporters to a host of congressional offices in the House of Representatives. Luke Rosiak, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's very good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's try to get as much ground truth out as we can about what we know about this investigation so far, those who are involved and whence they came and any associations they may have.
So there's four family members who were all working as IT guys on Capitol Hill on for House Democrats. There are three brothers, Imran Awan, Abid Awan, and Jamal Awan. They're from Pakistan. And Imran, the eldest brother, he had a wife named Hina Alvi. And the four of them all had the same job. They were, just as you would imagine, an IT guy. They're the guy that, you know, plugs in your mouse, fixes the computers. And, you know, these house offices are small enough that they don't each need their own full-time IT guy. So each of them were working for about 5 to 10 offices at a time. So basically you had 40-plus House Democrats who were employing these people, and they had full access to the computer networks, the House network.
So not just the networks of these members, but through those members of the larger House networks, is that what you're saying?
It's not entirely clear, but I believe they had access to the entire House network and certainly to all the emails of the members that they worked for. These IT guys have access to a whole lot, and it's hard to oversee them. If you're a non-technical person who's employing a technical person, you don't really know what he's doing. You just have to trust that his methods are appropriate. So I don't think that the members employing them really knew what they were doing, but there was a whole lot of members employing them, and that includes Debbie Wasserman Schultz,
former head of the Democratic National Committee, who had a fair amount of problems, as I recall, at the DNC with email security.
Exactly.
And there's actually been a report, I can't remember whether it was in the Daily Caller or another, but that she is actually still using the services of one or more of these folks. Is that possible?
That's right. If you can believe it, for all of her outrage about, you know, supposedly the Russians hacking the Democratic National Committee, she hears from the Capitol Police that it's likely that her office information improperly accessed by their own IT guy, and she doesn't fire him. He's still on the payroll. Now, the Capitol Police have taken away their access to the House network, which pretty much means they can't do their job. But I guess the thinking is kind of like these Democrats are concerned about due process. You never would want to fire someone unless, you know, prove it or whatever exactly. So,
But you put them on administrative leave at the very least. There's another aspect of this, as I understand it, Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller, and that is that these guys are accused of actually having stolen property from Capitol Hill as well. Is that right? Not just emails and data?
In fact, they're saying it's primarily a procurement scheme. That's how they understand it right now, that these are guys that basically just wanted money, and they were likely basically taking computers that were unused out of house offices and selling them, or charging too much money for hardware that they may have been selling to the offices. It's unclear exactly, but basically it amounts to theft. But then there's another component, which is still what you know, we really don't have any information about yet, which is that they do have full access to all the information. And critically, there was a server that was outside of the house that basically no one knew about. And they were doing this audit of the network, and they found this server that information was leaving the house and going to an external server. And apparently that was something that these guys had set up without really anyone's knowledge, and that would not be typical of house security to have information just leaving the Capitol complex.
Well, just to be clear, it may not have been without anyone's knowledge, but without knowledge of the people who were employing them, that's for sure. And Luke, I know that there's not a whole lot of hard information out there, but one of the things that we have seen in the past is the very aggressive efforts of the Pakistani intelligence services to operate against members of Congress. And the fact that these guys are of Pakistani origin may suggest that, or for that matter, other ties that would move this beyond just the improper handling of information. And I guess I would just ask you if you can comment on that. Great. If not, based on what you know, is the sort of information that these guys would have had routine access to likely to be of interest to foreign intelligence services, for example?
Well, among the members that they were working for, you've got at least three members of the Intelligence Committee, five members of the Foreign Affairs Committee, at least one member of the Homeland Security Committee. So, you know, the members that they were working for were pretty connected to the kind of information that such people would be interested in. Now, the committees themselves have their own offices, you know, with professional staff that works for the committee. It wouldn't be accurate to say that, you know, a member of a committee has full access to that committee's files.
And it's specifically classified networks that those committees like the Intelligence Committee would operate.
I think probably the Intelligence Committee is one of the only or the only committee that has its own classified network. That's absolutely the exception. But you're right. I mean, just because they're working for a member of the Intelligence Committee doesn't mean that they have full access to the Intelligence Committee's files themselves, thank God.
But they might have had more access to, the Foreign Affairs Committee or the Homeland Security or maybe Armed Services Committee's files. These are incredibly portentous early indications of what's afoot here, Luke, and I'm kind of struck that there hasn't been more pickup on this story so far as I've seen. Are you surprised at that? And do you think that it warrants, you know, I'm particularly concerned about what it might suggest is true more generally of our government at the moment, not just the Hill, but a lack of sort of appreciation of the importance for being engaged aggressively in counterintelligence kinds of operations.
Yeah, I'm surprised there hasn't been more pickup. I was the first person to name these guys. And, you know, even on its surface, it's a pretty outrageous scheme to have four people, all of whom were relatives and all making $160,000 a year, which is three times higher than most IT guys make. And this is something that hundreds of people would have known were going on, you know, that we have all these relatives, obvious nepotism, obvious something unusual going on with the salaries. So that's something that really no one among the House Democrats called attention to for a long time. And then I named these guys and you really don't have any follow-up in the other media outlets as well. I don't know if you saw my most recent follow-up on it, but these guys had serious money problems, which kind of could indicate their motives. I mean, it could be something more deep, or maybe these are just guys that have serious money problems.
But on the other hand, if you've got money problems and you've got stuff that's worth money to people who would not otherwise have access to it, that's a classic intelligence play too.
That's why they do, you know, check your credit and check for debts when you're doing background screenings. Because if you have a lot of debts and you have access to privileged information, you're very susceptible to someone approaching you and saying, you know, I really want to get those intelligence files.
Indeed. And Luke, very quickly, we're out of time, but do you have a reading on whether these guys had any kind of background checks done on them?
I would say they almost certainly didn't. I mean, one of them had bankruptcy, they had lawsuits, they had criminal records. One of them was convicted of a crime a month before starting on the Hill and arrested again a month after. But each office operated at its own fiefdom. I think they got in with one House member and basically were referred by word of mouth, and the other offices likely didn't do much screening at all.
This is a travesty, and we don't know the half of it, I'm pretty sure of that, Luke Kruziak, but I know that you will stay on the case, and I hope that we'll have a chance to continue getting updates from you about it. I personally think this is a very big story and want to make sure that those involved are accountable, and the lessons are properly learned about the need to improve our counterintelligence awareness and our operational security, needless to say. Thanks for the work you do at the Daily Caller. Come back to us again very soon, Luke. Next up, we'll be talking with David Satter about developments in Russia and our relationship with Vladimir Putin. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest is David Satter, one of the great journalists and authors and movie makers and savants, in short, about most especially Russia, a place he'd spent a lot of time in, both under the Soviet rule, misrule, and in the years since. He is these days a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, also the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and my alma mater, Johns Hopkins University's Advanced School of International Studies. He is the author most recently of The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. He is always welcome here. We catch up with him in Kiev, in Ukraine. David Satter, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. It's good to catch up with you.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you, Frank.
David, you have done some incredibly important work in sort of both your investigative reportorial role and as an author about the way Vladimir Putin came to power. And I just would like to sort of recap with that before we get into a conversation with you about Donald Trump and Yeltsin's relationship. Remind us of the early days of Putin's ascendancy.
Well, Putin was prime minister of Russia in 1999. He was newly appointed when apartment buildings began to be blown up in Moscow and in other Russian cities. And those bombings were used to justify a new war in Chechnya. And the popularity rating of Putin went way up as a result of the war, because he was seen as the national savior. He was seen as someone who was avenging horrific attacks on innocent Russian people who were murdered as they slept. And that got him elected president. He had no chance of being elected president before that because he was tainted by his association with Yeltsin. Yeltsin was massively unpopular. But then after he was elected, evidence began to accumulate, in fact, that the bombings were not the work of Chechen terrorists who were blamed for them, but rather the work of the FSB, the Russian security police, and they were done specifically in order to justify that war and to put Putin into power.
David Satter is our guest, and David, describe that evidence of the FSB's, the former KGB's, role in these bombings, apparently, and whether that actually links directly to Putin, a former KGB officer.
Well, the evidence is pretty overwhelming. There were four bombings in Moscow in which people were killed. A fifth bomb was discovered in the basement of a building in Ryazan, a city southeast of Moscow. And the city was cordoned off, and three people were arrested for putting the bomb in the building. They turned out not to be Chechen terrorists. They turned out to be FSB agents. At that point, the FSB announced that this was a training exercise, that this was not a real attempt to bomb the building. But that was completely implausible. I mean, in the case of a real training exercise, all of the local authorities would have been fully informed, and none of them were.
And you wouldn't have put real explosives in the basement, right?
There was a live military detonator, and the bomb tested positive for hexagon, the high explosive that was used to blow up the other four buildings.
So is there evidence that Putin was implicated in this directly, David Satter?
Well, it's hard to know. He was the former head of the FSB. The man who was head of the FSB at the time that this occurred was Putin's protege. Putin
was elevated as a result of this incident to the presidency. The whole thing was apparently planned by the Yeltsin entourage in order to put someone safe into power.
To protect Yeltsin in due course.
To protect Yeltsin. And after Putin was elected president, on the basis of a surge of popularity connected with his leadership of the Second War in Chechnya, his first official act was to pardon Yeltsin of any crimes he may have.
It's a circumstantial case, perhaps, but powerfully compelling. David, I just wanted to move quickly to two other topics. One, there is an individual by the name of Vladimir Kara-Murza, who is apparently in desperate straits at the moment. Tell us a little bit about him and whose fingerprints might be on his circumstance as well.
Well, Vladimir Kara-Murza, among other things, is a friend of mine. He's the coordinator for Open Russia, which is Mikhail Khodorkovsky's human rights organization and opposition political organization in Russia. And he was traveling around in Russia showing a film, actually, about Boris Nemtsov, his good friend who was murdered, the former leader of the opposition, who was murdered in February 2015. Now, Vladimir himself was poisoned 2 years ago, and he showed symptoms that were identical to those he's demonstrating now. He's in an artificial coma. He's experiencing organ failure. We have to just pray that he'll get through this somehow. But the fact that he's being poisoned in exactly the same way and under parallel circumstances indicates not only that the FSB is involved in it, but who else is able to carry out that kind of poisoning under such, twice over the course of 2 years, and under similar circumstances, but also that they're not shy about indicating to people that it was their work.
Yeah, no accident, comrade, as the Soviets were fond of saying. So this brings us to the present question, the public policy question of the moment, David Satter, and that is the lengths to which President Trump seems to be going to, give Vladimir Putin a pass, shall we say, at best, and at worst, kind of implying that the United States is similarly guilty of rather bad behavior, shall we say. Talk a little bit about the strategic implications of that, not just, the moral problems, but what might really be the dangerous fruit that comes of it.
I think that President Trump is not fully aware of the effect his words have on a foreign audience. He may not be that much that sensitive to the effect they have in the U.S., but when Russians hear statements like that, they will see it as a green light to go out and carry out assassinations, because the Russian system doesn't really present any obstacles to political assassination of the elimination of political opponents. But the Russians do fear the foreign reaction. Well, Trump has just made it clear to them that they don't have to fear the foreign reaction, at least as far as the president of the United States is concerned, because we do the same thing. And the Russians are also likely to be amazed that he would make a statement like that, which absolutely mirrors their own propaganda. What they're trying to do is convince their own people that any crimes they commit are committed equally by others. Trump has played right into their hands.
Mm-hmm. And you, David Satter, have spent a lot of time in the world, well beyond the Kremlin, of course. And I'm sure that this is something that is being heard by other foreign audiences with a great deal of fear and trepidation, because it may well be that it's interpreted by the Kremlin as an open invitation to acts of murderous aggression elsewhere, not just at home. A very chilling thought. David, we have to leave it at that. I'm so sorry to say we are hard out of time. I wish you well on your travels and that you return safely, and we'll be in touch with us when you get back, as there's much more to discuss. Thank you so much for your time today and your superb work on so many fronts, including your book, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep. Keep it up, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will speak with Patrick Dunleavy about the dangers of jihad in jail, what it might mean for you, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Patrick Dunleavy, a former Deputy Inspector General for the New York State Department of Corrections. Drawing on that experience, among others, he has been the author of The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. He has also written recently at the terrific website of the Investigative Project on Terrorism, a piece entitled U.S. Ill-Prepared for Convicted Jihadis Ending Their Prison Sentences. He is Patrick Dunleavy, and always a welcome guest here. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Frank. Thanks for having me.
You have, as I say, been on the other side of the wire, dealing up close and personally with the penal system and its inhabitants. We've talked from time to time, Patrick, about this phenomenon of what I think of as jihad in jail. Could you just sort of level set for us on how significant a problem you think this is? Let's start with what's going on inside the prison systems, and then we'll talk about what happens when these guys get out.
Well, there's actually two components that contribute to radicalization in prison. One is the fact that there are convicted terrorists like El Said Nasser and others who come into the prison system and exert influence on other inmates. And then there is also the systemic teachings of prison clergy and religious volunteers who have not been properly vetted, many of whom come from a Wahhabi Salafist ideology in Islam. And so as that happens, you have those two different components working on what are basically disenfranchised individuals with a propensity for violence and already have animosity towards authority, and that's what gives it the perfect soil for conversion. And we see that happening.
This is such an important point. I think that that soil has been exploited, among others, by a chap by the name of Abdurrahman Alamoudi, who, as I think you know, was a prime figure in the Muslim Brotherhood apparatus and also an Al-Qaeda financier before he was himself interred in Supermax on terrorism charges. But his chaplains, as I understand it, those he recruited and trained and credentialed, or at least some of them, still very much active in trying to plow, fertilize, and reap poisonous fruit from that soil. And one of the things that I understand is also an impetus behind this, Patrick Dunleavy, is that some in prison find this as a way to obtain protection from other inmates who might wish to do them harm of one kind or another. Is that a factor, as you see it, in recruiting and converting people to jihad?
Well, in some instances it is. In just the general nature of the prison environment, there are individuals who come in there who need to belong to a group in order to survive. So whether they join the Latin Kings or the Bloods or the Crips of the Aryan Nation, there's also individuals who join Muslims in prison as a form of protection. But we found that there was a filtering device between those individuals who convert to what we call Prislam to actual prison converts who were tutored in the actual fundamental ideology of Islam. And they were true converts. They were not just prison Islam. So there is that grouping of individuals who convert to Islam in prison. Some do it for protection. Others do it because in their souls they believe that they can now have a purpose in their life and atone for the mistakes they've made.
Yeah. Patrick Dunleavy is our guest, a former Deputy Inspector General for the New York State Department of Corrections. And Patrick, one of the things that I was struck by, to my knowledge, the only hearing that's been held on this subject, that may be wrong, but I certainly remember this one vividly, was in 2004 on Capitol Hill by then-Senator John Kyle. And he was very concerned about some of these practices, and in particular, what he learned about this fellow Alamudi's operations and the implications thereof. What was particularly striking about the testimony was he had officials from the federal prison system, wardens and others, as I recall, who were very enthusiastic about this Muslim chaplain program. And one of the reasons they offered was that these guys had an extraordinary ability to convert some of their most hardened criminal elements, the most violent of the felons, into model prisoners. And I presume that one of the things that model prisoners get is early release. And I wonder what your thoughts are, whether it's early release or whether it's presidential commutations of sentences or whether it's on any other basis, what the implications might be, knowing what you know about these characters, for public safety.
That's a good point. We know, first of all, that just the justice system in itself is an actual system that has different components. We know about investigations and arrests. We know about pretrial and post-trial appeals, but very few focus on incarceration and then post-incarceration release. Individuals who go into prison convert, they become model inmates. They don't assault staff. They don't get involved in a drug trade. They're not trying to escape. And so many of them, particularly individuals who have been convicted of terrorist acts, eventually get out of prison. The overwhelming majority of individuals who have been arrested and tried and convicted on terrorism crimes are not serving life sentences. Many of the individuals, like we talk about the Lackawanna Six, a group of Yemenis, Americans who trained to join Al-Qaeda, the Portland Seven, another group that was arrested in 2002 in the Virginia terror cell with Ali Al-Tamimi from Falls Church. Many of those individuals have already been released from prison. And there's no post-supervision. In other words, normally when an individual gets out of prison, there's a parole officer or probation officer who oversees where he works, what time he comes home, those type of conditions. But there's no specialized training for parole officers on how to deal with a released jihadi.
It makes you want to scream, doesn't it? It's prompted, I think, or actual problems arising from this practice have prompted, as I understand it, up in New York State, legislation to try to have a similar kind of, residential identification program to sexual predators who've been released by prison, authorities. I think that that may not be a substitute for careful monitoring of their behavior, but it may at least protect neighborhoods from, being unaware that they are potentially harboring enemies in their midst.
That's one of my recommendations, and that goes not only to just notifying the community, but by and large, what that registration list did, particularly in the instance of sex offenders, is it notified the local authorities so that if an individual got out of prison, was convicted for a particular type of sex offense, the local sheriff or police chief was notified that this individual was in your community. Why would we not do that with convicted terrorists?
Yeah, no, just eminently sensible. Could you just give me 1 minute further on the general problem of criminal justice reform as you see it, Patrick Dunleavy? One of its great champions, of course, Barack Obama, has left office, thank God. But what's the current state of that movement as you see it and its dangers?
Well, I think what's being put out there, a lot of it is disinformation in regard to how individuals wind up in prison. Many people are being told that we need to give individuals a second chance. And who in life will not say, hey, at some point I made a mistake, give me another chance. But when you talk about individuals who've gone into prison, they didn't go into prison because they were arrested once. By and large, most of the individuals who are incarcerated have been through the system, have had some sort of probation, some sort of conditional releases before they wind up in prison. Most of the individuals in prison have extensive rap sheets, lists of arrests for other crimes. So that's one of the problems that we have in the misinformation.
And particularly the whole notion, as we've talked about in the past, Patrick Dunleavy, of these guys being just sort of people who are drug users and nonviolent at that is also distorted and misleading and downright dangerous. That's a subject for a further conversation with you, I hope, very soon. Patrick, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again in the near future, if you will. We'll talk about Saudi Arabia, the source of a great many of these problems, as a matter of fact, a so-called special relationship with them. Is that possible and desirable? Mark Lagon joins us on that and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by a friend and colleague of many years with whom I have been out of touch for altogether too long. He was the president of Freedom House after serving in government as an ambassador at large to combat trafficking in persons at the Department of State, also served as a deputy assistant secretary of state in international organizational affairs. He is these days the Centennial Fellow and a distinguished scholar at Georgetown University, my alma mater's School of Foreign Service. Mark Lagon is his name. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's terrific to reconnect and to have you aboard.
Frank, it's great to be with you and have a frank conversation.
Indeed. Frank is what we're all about here. Let me ask you to reprise for our audience a debate you participated in recently, the so-called Intelligence Squared debate, on the subject of, has the special U.S.-Saudi relationship outlived its usefulness? When we think of special relationships, more often we think about the U.S.-UK relationship, but talk a little bit about the nature of that U.S.-Saudi tie and what has made it special in its way over the years.
Well, we've had a tendency to treat the Saudi regime as friends, you know, without conditions. And we needed the Saudis more for oil for a number of decades. And now it's less the case with fracking, and less even the case that we need to have an unquestioning relationship with the Saudis in order for us to help maintain stability in the Middle East for the flow of oil for other countries. There are lots of things about U.S. credibility that is shot by hugging a country that stones and lashes and beheads people in a pretty medieval way. And frankly, it's supposed to be a partner in fighting terrorism, but it has helped export Wahhabist extremist thought around the world and minted terrorists rather than only being our terrorism partner.
Yeah, I guess what has been most special about it is our willingness to look the other way at what's, I think, best described as a sort of Saudi double game. You know, they'll buy weapons from us, they'll sell us oil, they'll take our protection, but they are, as you say, Mark, engaged in barbaric behavior at home and promoting its export elsewhere around the world, including in our own country. In the course of this debate, you were taking the position that it's time to revisit this relationship. Should we be contemplating its termination, or is there something that needs to be done to condition it in a way that makes their behavior rather better if they're going to have all of those bennies from us?
I don't think there's grounds for a divorce, but looking the other way on, you know, the way they mint terrorists with their subsidies for madrasas, religious schools around the world.
And mosques as well.
Yeah, they also are so cruel at home. It's not just something that, you know, kind of shocks the conscience and has to do with our values. It's a problem of interests. Are they creating a pressure cooker? They are a Sunni-oriented government. They are not only in the business of religious persecution against Christians and Jews, but even Shia Muslims, having early last year executed a senior Shia cleric ostensibly as a threat to their, you know, to stability, but really as part of their religious persecution, they're creating enemies for themselves in the United States. So we do need conditions, and I'd be happy to tell you what I think they ought to be.
Well, yeah, let's get into that a bit. One thing that I think needs to be mentioned, you talked a little bit about our fracking industry, giving us a measure of latitude that we might not have felt we had in the past in terms of energy, if not complete independence, certainly a degree of independence from Saudi that we didn't used to have. They have, of course, explicitly said, the Saudis, when they drove prices in the oil markets down dramatically a few years ago, as you know, I'm sure, Mark Lagon, that they were deliberately doing it to try to destroy America's fracking industry. So this is a very special kind of relationship that we would ignore that. But talk a little bit about the sorts of conditions that you think are in order in light of this sort of behavior on the part of the Saudis.
I do want to pick up on this point, you know, that they, you know, have tried to manipulate prices to harm our fracking capability.
Actually, destroy it was the word they put, I think, in front of it.
And they also regularly try and blackmail us if they don't like something that we're proposing to do, including the families of 9/11 victims wanting to sue their government in court, as a law recently passed allowed. You know, they threaten to withhold intelligence cooperation. If they really have overlapping interests with us, they would never threaten to withhold intelligence information or cooperate. You asked me what conditions to place on them. I wrote this in an article in the National Interest earlier this year and argued this in the debate in New York the other night. I think we should condition our massive arms sales to Saudi Arabia. We sell nearly 10% of all the arms that the United States sells to other countries to Saudi Arabia. If we're going to do that, we might want to ask, one, would you audit all those Wahhabist charities in Saudi Arabia and make sure that they are not supporting radicalizing clerics and schools worldwide? They have done a bit on that, but they haven't done enough. And if they're ostensibly our anti-terrorism partner, they need to do that. Then, secondly, I think we need to, instead of looking at human rights as a values issue, we need to remember it's sometimes in our interest. They've set up at a very low level an ability for women to vote in municipal elections, and they say, in part as in their plan to modernize the economy and not be as reliant on oil, they want to get women into the workforce. But they have something close to gender apartheid, where you have to have a male accompany you to work, to vote, to go do anything. You need the permission of the man you're married to or who's your father. If they're really serious about integrating women into a more revitalized economy, then they need to remove their guardian requirement for women, get into the 20th century or before they even can manage to get into the 21st.
Mark Lagon, one last point on this. The question that is sometimes bruited about in these topics and this conversation is that there is a new sheriff in town here, obviously, Donald Trump, but there's kind of a new force at work in the senior ranks of the Saudi government, this Mohammed bin Salman, the deputy crown prince.
Right.
He's a modernizer, we're told. He's trying to improve relations with us and the like. Do you regard that as more substantial or less substantial a change? And how do you think it will factor into actual Saudi behavior?
Well, the new king, his dad, is 80 years old, and he's the last of a set of brothers who are all the sons of the founder of Saudi Arabia. So the end of the, you know, the octogenarians rule is nigh. You know, he's in his early 30s, and he has been an advocate of economic reform, something called Vision 2030, to modernize, even privatize some aspects of the economy. But we've heard plans like this, so the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. The other thing is that he has been the point man on defense policy. He's defense minister, and he has been responsible for the policy of use of force in Yemen that hasn't served U.S. interests and has harmed innocent civilians in the thousands.
Yeah, it's a subject we will come back to now that we have found you again, Mark Lagon. Thank you very much for your time and for this most interesting contribution to a debate that I hope is taking place not just in New York, but in senior councils of the United States government as well. We appreciate your service to our country and those councils as well. Mark, come back to us again very soon. Next up, Gordon Chang will join us to talk about Trump's apparent embrace of the One China policy. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We have a special appearance by our duty expert on Asia, Gordon Chang, to talk about important developments over the past day with respect to the seemingly shifting U.S. policy under President Donald Trump towards China, specifically in the course of a call with Xi Jinping, his Chinese counterpart. He seemed to signal that he was not actually revisiting the whole underlying concept of U.S.-Chinese relations over the past few decades, namely the One China policy. So who better to talk to about all that than our friend Gordon Chang. Welcome back, Gordon. Good to have you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
So we had been enthusing, you and I, over the past few weeks about what seemed to be a willingness on the part of Donald Trump to chart a different course than what has gotten us into, I think, our present fix with the Chinese. Do you take the call yesterday as evidence that that's now over the side and it's business more or less as usual, or what should we make of this?
Yes, that's the only conclusion that one can come to, especially after looking at the White House readout of the call between Trump and Xi Jinping. The readout says that Trump acknowledged the One China policy, and that certainly is different than the call that he had with Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen on December 2nd. Also, it's different from his December interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, as well as his interview in the Wall Street Journal in January. So clearly the Chinese or somebody got to him. And this is really unfortunate because the Chinese saw this as a test of will. The New York Times is reporting that Xi Jinping refused to talk to Trump until he publicly acknowledged the One China policy. And so, therefore, we can only interpret this as a capitulation.
Well, what we interpret it to be is one thing, of course. The bigger problem is how the Chinese perceive it. And China, as you know very well, Gordon, has a tradition of the kowtow, the barbarian submitting to the domination of China. Is that how this will be read in Beijing, do you think? And if so, Gordon, against the backdrop of the stuff we talk about each week the Chinese are up to in the South and East China Seas and their nuclear programs, ballistic missiles being postured in threatening ways and so on, how is this likely to translate into future policy on the part of Beijing?
Well, Beijing will certainly see this that a test of will, that they have won a quick victory. And so, therefore, I think they'll probably become even more arrogant, which means that Trump has fed their sense of power and the sense of American weakness. So I think that it's going to be much more difficult across the board. Now, on substance, we're hoping that Trump's visit today with Abe, who is coming to the White House, we hope that this will be good. I hope that Trump publicly acknowledges that Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Defense Treaty covers the Senkaku Islands, which are disputed between Japan and China, but which are indeed administered by Japan. And so, therefore, that would be very good. And hopefully we will see Abe come to terms with Trump on economic issues, thereby clearing them off the table. But nonetheless, with regard to the Chinese, this is a very dark day for American relations with Beijing.
Gordon, let me ask you, do you think that the fact that the president was about to meet with Abe was some way a factor in the decision that he needed to talk to the Chinese, having not done so, as I understand it, to this point in his presidency? Was there some sort of pressure upon him to have started this conversation with the Chinese, even if it meant basically doing it on their terms?
That is indeed the drift of reporting so far, that the Chinese were very worried about the Abe meeting. They wanted to make sure that things were on a good footing with themselves. And so therefore, I think that they worked very hard to pressure Trump. And so therefore, that is indeed the suggestion that we are reading in various outlets.
But again, if the Chinese wanted the call, wouldn't that have actually given Trump the leverage to say, well, we'll do it, but on my terms?
Absolutely. And also, I think that it would have been even better for Trump not to have taken the call, in the sense that the Chinese would have felt that they were out in the cold, that they were certainly well behind Japan in the priorities of the new administration. You know, we talk to the Chinese too much. You know, we chase after them. We seem to be desperate for dialogue, as well as ones before it. And so we have taught the Chinese that they are very important in our estimation, and they've taken advantage of that. So I was looking forward to a period where there were very few contacts between the Trump administration and Xi Jinping, because that would have been good for the United States. That would, I think, have made the Chinese more willing to come to terms with us on a number of issues, and might have even stopped some provocative behavior. But now I think there's very little chance of the Chinese moving in better directions, because they've won what they saw as a crucial test, that they were able, in their eyes, to humiliate the Trump administration.
Yeah, I'm deeply troubled by this, as you obviously are as well, Gordon. Before we turn to the Abe visit, just one last question on this. When we spoke earlier about the prospects for a more sound, more sensible U.S. policy towards China, I know you had taken great encouragement, not only from that call you mentioned with the Taiwanese leader, but also the personnel that Donald Trump was putting in place around him, notably our friend Dr. Peter Navarro, for example, and the Commerce Secretary and so on. What do you think those advisors make of this? Would they have been blindsided? Would they have been complicit in some way? Is that possible, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know what the deliberations were inside the Trump administration with regard to the people that you mentioned. But clearly, Peter Navarro has a much more skeptical attitude towards China. So does Matt Pottinger, who is the Asia director for Michael Flynn, the national security advisor. There are all sorts of people who have really great views on China, including Alex Gray, who works for Peter. And so, you know, therefore, there are a lot of people in this administration who have very sound views on China. I don't know whether they were consulted or they're left out of the process. We do know that the Chinese were working on Trump's family, and perhaps that's how this came about. But however it came about, and there's a lot of stuff in the New York Times on this, there is just a very sad day for America-China policy. This is not the end. You know, Trump can always recover. But nonetheless, he's got to dig himself out of a very big hole, because the Chinese have now a very prideful and arrogant attitude towards us.
Yeah, and I'm afraid towards him specifically. Gordon, in quick conclusion, let me ask you, there is an opportunity, of course, to send a rather different signal in the course of his conversations with Prime Minister Abe from Japan. You mentioned the Senkakus. It's my understanding that Jim Mattis, when he was out in the region last week, made clear that we consider them territory that we would defend should they be attacked by the Chinese. What kinds of signals do you expect to come out of this meeting, and how important is it that, to the extent we can, we make sure that the Chinese are under no illusion about that relationship with Japan?
The one signal that we know is that Trump is working very hard to develop a personal relationship with Shinzo Abe. And also, Abe is trying very hard to develop the relationship with Trump. I don't know how the commercial issues will play out, but I do hope that Trump does give that Article 5 confirmation. Secretary of Defense Mattis gave it on Saturday. And we got to remember that just 2 days after Mattis gave that confirmation when he was in Tokyo, the Chinese sent three of their Coast Guard cutters into Japanese territorial waters around the Senkaku Islands. That was not only a warning to Japan, but it was a sign of disrespect to the United States, to Mattis in particular. And so, therefore, we need to do something today so that the Chinese know that we will defend the Senkakus, and that perhaps this phone call mishap is something to be put in the past.
Let us pray. Gordon Chang, thank you so much as always for your time, especially on short notice. We'll look forward to catching up with you at our regular visit next Monday, perhaps to have some better news to reflect upon out of the Abe visit. In the meantime, stay well. We'll talk with you again next week. To the rest of you, thank you for joining us. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week as well. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.